chapter 5 How to be spiritual, before any attempt is made to give instructions on how to be spiritual, we must first have a clear-cut idea of what is meant by the term. Before we can intelligently discuss how to get something, we must first know what it is that we are trying to get. Yet the idea of spirituality commonly held is anything but clear-cut and well-defined. To be sure, the word spiritual is to be heard on every lip in all those circles which converse so fluently about the aspirations of the human heart. Yet I can recall no word that conveys so many divergent meanings, or about which, in the minds of those who speak of it most frequently, there is such utter confusion. It seems to be taken for granted, by those who write and talk so assuredly about it, that there is nothing of higher import to man. Yet, when pinned down to any clearer statement, opinions differ as widely as the poles, or at least as widely as West is from East, for the Oriental conception of spirituality varies from the Occidental conception no less than the dreamy, passive temperament of the peoples of such languid climes is opposed by the aggressive, red-blooded enterprise of a temperamentally vigorous and virile race. There is prevalent today an Oriental notion of spirituality that arises from the view that life is an intolerable condition, to be endured only because it is forced upon the individual and cannot be avoided, and that whatever effort must be expended may best be devoted to those acts which will enable the individual to escape from the wheel of karma and rebirth into the negation of nirvana. But entwined with these purely Oriental notions are numerous inheritances from Christianity, long since outgrown in their actual practice, but which theoretically are expounded as spiritual virtues. No one is so impractical, for instance, as to insist that a gangster shall take still other of his belongings when the gangster, either by force of arms or by law, takes part of them, although we are still taught from the pulpit it is a virtue to give a man one's cloak, if by law he takes away one's coat. Nor when smitten do we turn the other cheek, for if we did we should suffer the fate of those adjoining nations that offered no resistance to Hitler, or the same fatality that overtook the one who gave this precept. Most of us recognize that the doctrine of meekness leads to slavery, and that instead of mourning being a blessing, it is physiologically a crime. Yet these and a dozen other notions, including the idea that deity is pain to see man enjoy himself, and that the saintly life is lived only by those who make themselves unusually miserable, are vaguely blended with Oriental views on the desirability of escaping life, and together comprise what passes among many for spirituality. The Oriental views I have discussed in some detail in lessons number 20, number 21. And number 129, and in lesson number 129 I have analyzed some of the obvious absurdities of Christianity. Here, therefore, I shall not consume space by discussing such ideas. Nor are they here mentioned in the carping, fault-finding spirit, but only because no clear conception of real spirituality can be presented without at least thus briefly sweeping away the rubbish and debris with which the centuries have covered it, and because, further, it is only fair to make plain at the start of this discourse that there is a distinctly Western conception of spirituality, which is quite dissimilar to either that of the Orient or that of Orthodox Christianity. This dissimilarity is most pronounced. For instance, the Western cosmic alchemist places very little emphasis on what people are not to do, and instead of the many prohibitions of the Orient and the thou shalt nots of Christianity, he constantly insists that something should be done, and points out specifically what that something is. Instead of a vocabulary of Sanskrit words that to most Western students may mean nothing or anything, instead of the Latin and physiological pageantry employed by the Roman Catholics to impress their devotees with the holiness of their leaders, and instead of the ambiguous and contradictory passages that Protestants make mean anything they wish, and thus are able to present a scriptural quotation to prove whatever they may desire. The Western school uses as plain language as possible, carefully defines such technical terms as must be employed, and if any feeling of mystery lingers in the student's mind, deems that its work has been ineffectually presented. Then again, a certain mood of fatality and inevitability is engendered by the Eastern doctrines, and while predestination is not so vigorously debated in the Church as it once was, the conception still prevails in Christian circles, that instead of being dependent upon initiative, intelligence and effort, man is largely dependent upon the grace and mercy of a divine being, who can be wheedled into granting special and quite unmerited favors. But the cosmic alchemist perceives that all nature is under law, and not subject to the whims and caprices of either Jehovah or his son. That their intelligence is higher than man he has good reason to believe. Nor does he scoff at prayers, but considers that they also operate under laws, and these laws he strives to understand. He believes, furthermore, that there is an all-pervading thick intelligence whom he calls God. But above all, he emphasizes the importance, not of permitting things to happen because apparently they are foreordained, but of applying initiative and intelligence towards making those things happen, which he deems to be in the direction of individual betterment and human and universal progress. He considers man not merely as an inert and passive creature, but as a dynamic force capable of uniting himself to deity for the purpose of accomplishing a useful and progressive work in the constantly expanding domain of universal development. Spiritual values now either spirituality is real, and has come meaning to life, or it is a vague nothingness. If it has a value to life, it must contribute either to quantity or to quality, that is, to length of life or to its richness, because aside from these two there can be no value. Orientals imply, with their doctrine of repeated human births on earth, that the region where the human soul can effectively express itself is more restricted and narrow, while Western cosmic alchemists find innumerable realms in space in which, by means of finer vehicles, mankind can work and develop, and continue a vividly self-conscious and progressive existence. But if life has a value, both its duration and what is thought, felt and done in its duration are significant. We never hear the term spirituality applied to mere duration of life. At least the duration of physical life cannot be used as a measure of spirituality. For although a sequoia tree may gain experiences that contribute quality during its existence, it is probable that its spirituality is much less than that of many men, who live less than 1/40th of the time it thrives on earth. Yet duration of life, because it affords the opportunity to develop the soul, and affords man the opportunity to gain spiritual treasures, has a very real value. Mere duration of life is not spirituality, as spirituality depends upon how the duration is utilized. The opportunity is not the treasure, but has a value, in that it makes it possible to obtain the treasure yet aside from this duration, which has spiritual value only as an opportunity, there is left of life only one thing of value, and that is the quality of life. Consequently, true spirituality must in some manner relate to the quality of the thoughts, feelings and actions of life. Experiences add states of consciousness to the soul, and these through increasing the knowledge give a certain quality to the life. Yet many thoughts, feelings and actions, while affecting the quality of the life, do not increase its spirituality. Spirituality is not intelligence, it is not merely activity, nor is it merely knowledge, nor all of these three. It is not the quality of life resulting from its complexity, but the quality of life that, irrespective of its complexity, tends to lift it to a higher level. Even as physical objects have two other dimensions than that of length, so has life two distinct and different measurements of quality. Of course, considered from the standpoint of the movements of a physical, and therefore three-dimensional, entity, time is the fourth dimension. But when we measure states of consciousness, we must consider life from another view. And as we are familiar with three dimensions, all at right angles to each other, for the sake of simplicity of illustration, let us also consider life as having three dimensions, all at right angles to each other and thus to be measured much, as we measure the volume of some physical object. From this analogical viewpoint, we may as well consider time, as most people do, as the measure of the length of life. As the breadth of anything is measured at right angles to its length, from this viewpoint it would seem that the breadth of life would be measured by the number, variety and intensity of its experiences. Thus, in one of its dimensions, a life is rich in proportion to the amount of thought, feeling and action packed into it. Yet however active a man may be, however varied his experiences, however much he has felt, and however much knowledge he has acquired, from these and the length of his life its value cannot be completely measured. To appraise its worth, in addition to these two measurements at right angles to each other, there is needed another measurement at right angles to both of these, even as to measure physical volume, the thickness of that which is to be measured must be ascertained, as well as the length and breadth. This dimension of thickness, when applied to man's life, relates to the refinement, or vibratory level, of the thoughts, feelings and actions. It is the distance these are above those of the brutes. It is the lowness or the height of this vibratory level that affords, regardless of the length of the life or its richness in breadth, the true measure of its spirituality. In the first lesson on the next life, lesson number 173, it is explained that there are innumerable levels of the inner plane world, on each of which life exists. Each level has its own basic vibratory rate. And it is there pointed out that everything has a dominant vibratory rate, and that on the inner plane the principle of resonance supersedes the law of gravitation. Not only after physical dissolution, but insofar as the astral form and soul are concerned, while they are still in the flesh, people gravitate to the inner plane level, the basic vibratory rate, of which most nearly is that of their own dominant vibratory rate. This attraction is as inevitable, and as powerful, as is the force of gravitation to hold their physical bodies to the earth. Thus, from the inner plane effect, we have a quite clear criterion of that which tends in the direction of spirituality.